Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. We're going to start with some sports news, which you may think is outside the province of this show, but this particular piece of sports news is extremely big business. This is from Fortune magazine, dated August 19th. The Los Angeles Lakers record $12.5 billion sale. It resets the market for sports teams. This week's news that billionaire venture capitalist Josh Kushner and former Disney CEO Bob Iger would buy a controlling stake in the Los Angeles Lakers at a record-breaking $12.5 billion valuation, first reported by ESPN Wednesday morning, comes as a shock in more ways than one. The deal breaks Mark Walters' own record for the purchase of a professional sports team, less than a year after his $10 billion deal to take a controlling interest in the Lakers from the Buss family, who sold the team after 46 years, closed last October, and once again resets the value for the rest of the market for the NBA. The decades-long surge in sports team values hasn't been a linear trajectory. Before Walter's $10 billion splurge for the Lakers last year, the highest prices ever paid for control stakes in sports teams were Bill Chisholm's $6.1 billion acquisition of the Boston Celtics early in 2025 and Josh Harris's $6.05 billion deal for the Washington Commanders in 2024. Sports teams are genuinely valued at a multiple of the revenue they generate, and when one person is willing to pay a much higher premium than the prior consensus, it often raises valuations across the entire league. But the sky apparently has no limit. Last year's average multiple for NBA teams was 12.9 times revenue, and the $10 billion that Walter paid for the Lakers was 18 times the team's $551 million in revenue in the prior season. Yet the 66-year-old Walter, CEO of TWG Global, still managed to get a 25% return on that investment in 1 year, well above the league's typical annual revenue growth rate, signaling an even higher multiple for this transaction. The exponential step function nature of team valuations has handsomely rewarded long-term team owners, but until this week, it was unprecedented for a sports team to be flipped like a piece of real estate. Before Walter's 10-month tenure as control owner, no other owner who's bought an NBA team since 2000 held it for less than 5 years, and the Lakers are now the only team to change hands multiple times in the last 15 years. But here's a question about any kind of transaction that's this large. Will it go smoothly? Here's an article from Fortune magazine and the Associated Press dated August 19th about how the Buss family feels about this. The Buss family wants an exit gracefully. Jeannie Buss says no. Los Angeles Lakers governor Jeannie Buss is legally contesting her siblings' plan to sell the family's remaining 17.8% minority ownership stake in the team to Josh Kushner and Bob Iger, according to a letter obtained Monday by the Associated Press. ESPN and The Athletic first reported that the siblings had voted to sell the family trust's remaining interest in the 17-time NBA championship team purchased by their father Jerry Buss in 1979. The decision would end Jeannie Buss's tenure as the Lakers governor because that job requires at least 15% ownership of the team. Jeannie Buss's attorney, Adam Streisand, wrote to representatives for her five siblings to state that any decision to sell the family trust's ownership stake could not be effectuated without the approval of the current co-trustees, Jeannie, Janie, and Joey Buss. The letter further states that the co-trustees are bound to vote the Los Angeles Lakers incorporated shares to ensure that the minimum 15% ownership requirement is maintained in order to ensure that Genie Bus may remain controlling owner. Any attempt by the co-trustees to do otherwise, and any attempt to aid or abet the co-trustees as such, would constitute a breach of trust, a breach of fiduciary duty, and be in contempt of court. Genie Bus has been the Lakers' governor since Jerry Buss's death in 2013, and she led the family's decision to sell a controlling stake in the Lakers to Dodgers owner Mark Walter last year at a valuation of $10 billion. Walter, who was under federal investigation for tax issues, abruptly reached a deal earlier this month to flip the Lakers to Kushner and Iger at a valuation of $12.5 billion, another record for a pro sports team. Venture capitalist Kushner and former Disney CEO Iger are reportedly buying about 65% of the team from Walter. They would own about 83% if they reach a deal with the Bus siblings. And Genie Bus would lose the governor role that she's been slated to keep, at least through 2030, under the deal with Walter. The Bus siblings have been in frequent conflict since their father's death, with Genie Bus firing Jim from his job as the Lakers' head of basketball operations in 2017, followed a week later by a lawsuit against her brothers amid an attempt by Jim and Johnny to oust Genie from her role as the Lakers' controlling owner. Not all of the six Bus siblings were in favor of the sale to Walter, and Joey and Jesse were fired from their front office jobs with the team last November. The siblings say they voted this month to sell their family's remaining interest in the Lakers, but Genie Bus claims any vote is void. ESPN reported that Genie Bus was the only sibling who didn't support the final sale. And there you have it, folks. Will it go smoothly? Stay tuned. Now we're going to do two articles about Anthropic's upcoming IPO and its corporate valuation in that IPO. Here's a short squib on Anthropic's current revenue levels. Again, from Fortune magazine, dated August 18th, Anthropic books $65 billion in revenues. Anthropic's annual revenue rate has hit $65 billion ahead of its IPO, which is expected later this year. That's seven times the size of its sales at the end of 2025, Bloomberg reported, when its revenues were only $9 billion. If Anthropic's IPO plans stay on track, it'll go public in the fall before either OpenAI or DeepSeek, which are also expected to offer stock on the public marketplace. Now a much longer article about the valuation of Anthropic versus its IPO level. This is from Amanda Garut from Fortune magazine, dated August 17th. Anthropic needs to bring in Amazon-style earnings to justify its $2 trillion valuation, but it's barely turned a profit. Anthropic investors have been kicking the tires on what could be the most valuable initial public offering in history. A handful of the Frontier Labs backers confirmed to the Financial Times this week that they expect privately held Anthropic to go public in October, with a targeted valuation of $2 trillion or higher, which easily eclipses SpaceX's record-breaking $1.77 trillion IPO in June. That valuation would more than double the $965 billion the company was worth when it reported a Series H funding round in May. Bloomberg, meanwhile, has reported that Anthropic is also in talks to buy the AI startup Descartes AI for $6 billion. Anthropic filed for an IPO confidentially with the Securities and Exchange Commission in June, but has not publicly set a timeline. Rival Frontier Lab OpenAI followed suit shortly after Anthropic, but is not expected to IPO until 2027. The awkward part of all of this is, though, that Anthropic isn't making money yet. Across the NASDAQ 100 universe, the index of large-cap tech companies that Anthropic would join post-IPO, the average company trades at roughly 34 times trailing earnings and 25 times forward earnings. At those multiples, a $2 trillion Anthropic would need to post annual profits in the neighborhood of $59 billion to $79 billion to keep pace. It could be getting closer, but the Claude chatbot purveyor led by Dario Amodi still has a long way to go. The Wall Street Journal reported that Anthropic's second quarter 2026 revenue would more than double to $10.9 billion, while the company would, for the first time, post an operating profit. But operating profit is not the same as net income. Operating profit tells investors whether the business is covering costs like salaries, compute, and research, but it doesn't account for interest on debt or taxes. Net income is what's left over after all of that is subtracted out. And for a company like Anthropic, with all the needs that go along with sustaining a bleeding-edge frontier lab, the distance between operating profit and actual bottom-line profit could be substantial. Avery Marquez, Director of Investment Strategies at Renaissance Capital, said approaching that threshold of a profitable bottom line will be key to make Anthropic's valuation palatable to public investors. Just seeing the $2 trillion number, it's definitely jolting, she said. Reaching near operating profitability will at least be something that, in my mind, makes this very large valuation maybe not seem so crazy. At $2 trillion, Anthropic would be keeping company with six other businesses in the world with valuations that size or more, plus Broadcom, which has been floating near the $2 trillion mark since first crossing it earlier this year. But just look at the profits of those six firms. NVIDIA's valuation is more than $5 trillion, and it earned $120.1 billion in net income last fiscal year on $215.9 billion in revenue. Alphabet, at $4.55 trillion, made $132 billion on $403 billion in revenue. Apple, at $4.49 trillion, earned $112 billion on $416 billion in revenue. Microsoft, at $3.7 trillion, posted $133.7 billion of net income in the year ended June 30th. Chipmaker TSMC, one of the most valuable companies outside the U.S., rounds out the group at $2 trillion. Anthropic would be closest to Amazon, which booked $77.7 billion in net income in its most recent fiscal year, although a portion of its own profits are a function of Anthropic's valuation. Amazon's most recent second quarter earnings show $62.6 billion of net income, and $53.4 billion of that was non-operating pre-tax income primarily from our investments in Anthropic, its earning release states. Anthropic's run rate revenue went from about $9 billion at the end of 2025 to $47 billion by mid-May. Outside data shared by Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff estimated Anthropic's run rate had reached $74.1 billion, surpassing OpenAI's $41.3 billion. Salesforce is an early investor and customer of Anthropic. Neither company has confirmed the figures, and Benioff shared data from Ticker Trends. What most impresses me about Anthropic, besides unprecedented revenue growth, is their enterprise hat trick, posted Benioff. The best model, Claude, the best coding agents, Claude Code, and the best productivity tool, Cowork. The two rival frontier model developers, OpenAI and Anthropic, are comparable to one another, noted Marquez, which means whichever company files first sets the benchmarks that every company that follows has to measure up against. Anthropic can tout its enterprise customer base, which is stickier and compounds more predictably than individual consumer subscriptions, which is where OpenAI's ChatGPT has the name brand recognition advantage. Then there's compute. Evan Schlossberg of NeoStellar Capital Corporation, whose fund holds a position in OpenAI, said the supply side of the business is the second thing he'll turn to once he has an S-1 prospectus filing for Anthropic, right after he looks at their definitions for revenue and how it defines key financial metrics. The question is, what does Anthropic source over the next 18 months, 24 months, of how much compute they will be able to access at any given time, said Schlossberg. Do they own that? Are they leasing it? Is it short-term leases? Is it long-term leases? The answer will be revealing. A company that owns its own servers or has locked in long-term leases has predictable costs and can squeeze performance out of its fleet of chips, making each dollar of revenue less expensive to deliver. Short-term leases can lead to spiking costs, scarce supply, and could leave Anthropic at the mercy of another company's pricing. If you're able to get slightly better margins out of the hardware you own, what is that showing in terms of overall margin, added Schlossberg? For its part, Anthropic has been locking in capacity. It has deals with Amazon, Google, Broadcom, and GPU access through SpaceX. If the Descartes deal closes, it would also bring in software that helps chips run more efficiently and an inference optimization team that could plug and play in Anthropic's organization. Marquez said lining up an acquisition before a roadshow is pretty common in the tech IPO world. Companies do it so the pro forma financials already reflect the acquisition, even if the numbers describe a combined business that hasn't actually operated together yet. Schlossberg said the $2 trillion valuation for Anthropic is exciting news as an OpenAI investor. If you see strong, credible demand for investments in Anthropic and escalating premiums on that revenue, it would speak to a reasonable analogy that you're seeing similar market trends for OpenAI, he said. It's the same sort of bull or bear case. He's also not worried about one lab side-tackling the other. If everyone in the world wanted to switch over to OpenAI tomorrow, or Anthropic tomorrow, or Gemini tomorrow, I don't believe those companies even have the compute to satiate that, he said. It seems less likely that you're going to have one model intelligence company dominate the global demand for intelligence. Marquez sees Anthropic's valuation turning up the heat for OpenAI. Whether it IPOs first or second barely matters for Anthropic, but it matters a lot for OpenAI, which will be priced against a live competitor if Anthropic goes first as planned. Anthropic's enterprise revenues are flattering, but hundreds of millions of people use ChatGPT. OpenAI will likely have to answer the strategic question as to whether it will continue pushing more deeply into enterprise where Anthropic is strong, or if it will lean into scaling more individual customers and monetizing advertising or paid conversions, she said. But OpenAI doesn't necessarily need to beat Anthropic at its own game, noted Marquez. It just has to arrive looking comparable, with similar growth and a credible path to profitability on an EBITDA basis. The hurdle Anthropic will need to overcome is establishing what financial metrics make sense for the company. The big hang-up for valuation is, what metrics make sense for this company, said Marquez. OpenAI will not have that problem, but it will have a very clear peer for investors to use for comparison. I don't think that's going to deter OpenAI at all, said Marquez. But I don't think it helps OpenAI for Anthropic to go first. Now we're going to talk about Donald Trump and Canada and his proposed tariffs on Canada. This article is from Fortune magazine and the Associated Press, dated August 18th. The negotiations are very intense and delicate. Carney and Trump hold crunch talks to avoid midnight 50% tariff deadline. The U.S. and Canada are negotiating in an effort to reach a truce on tariffs before a 12:01 a.m. Wednesday deadline set by U.S. President Donald Trump, and that Wednesday deadline is August 19th. If no deal is reached, Trump has threatened to impose 50% tariffs on $20 billion worth of Canadian products, ranging from hockey sticks to tongue depressors. "We are negotiating," Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney told reporters Monday, speaking in French. "The negotiations are very intense and delicate. This is not the time to talk about negotiations in public." The two countries have wrangled for decades over trade, poking each other over sore spots, like Canadian softwood lumber imports and U.S. access to Canada's protected dairy market. Somehow, they still manage to remain friends, allies, and trading partners. Canadian soldiers fought alongside Americans in Afghanistan after 9/11. The 5,525-mile U.S.-Canada border is undefended, and nearly 330,000 people and $2 billion worth of goods cross it every day. 800,000 Canadians live in the United States. Trump's belligerent approach to dealing with Canada marks an extraordinary departure from the traditionally cooperative relationship between the two countries. Trump has hit Canadian goods with tariffs in a push to bring manufacturing back to the United States, and has repeatedly made inflammatory comments about turning Canada into America's 51st state. The Canadian public is fed up. A petition to expel the U.S. ambassador, a Trump ally, has collected nearly 218,000 signatures since July 21st. It accuses Ambassador Pete Hoekstra of having normalized Trump's talk of annexing Canada, among other things. Nearly 72% of Canadian goods exports last year went to the United States, and the Trump administration might be wary of imposing a hefty new tariff paid by U.S. importers who try to pass along the cost to consumers via higher prices ahead of November's midterm elections. American voters are already frustrated with the high cost of living. "I don't think either side really wants these tariffs to come into effect," said Ryan Majerus, a partner at King & Spalding and a former U.S. trade official. "That's a pretty strong push on both sides to find an off-ramp here." Majerus said the United States is aiming to get Canada to buy more U.S. military equipment, including F-35 fighters, to take part in Trump's Golden Dome missile defense, and to give the United States more access to critical minerals, thereby reducing America's reliance on tenuous supplies from geopolitical rival China. The Canadians would like relief from U.S. tariffs on steel and aluminum, as well as softwood lumber, which America says receives unfair government subsidies. Trump has made tariffs the centerpiece of his second-term economic agenda. Last year, he imposed double-digit import taxes on almost every country on Earth, justifying them by declaring the long-standing U.S. trade deficit a national emergency. The Supreme Court in February ruled that he'd overstepped his authority, striking down those tariffs and setting the stage for federal government to pay refunds to importers. Trump immediately looked for other ways to rebuild his tariff wall. Last month, he imposed import taxes of 10% to 12.5% on 59 countries and the European Union, which together accounts for 99% of U.S. imports, for allegedly failing to have or to enforce restrictions on imports made from forced labor. Then he reached back to the Great Depression to find a cudgel with which to whack Canada, one of his favorite targets. Trump invoked Section 338 of the Tariff Act of 1930 to impose 50% tariffs on products that account for about 5% of Canadian exports to the United States. Nearly a century ago, with the U.S. and world economies in collapse, Congress passed the 1930 tariff law, imposing hefty taxes on imports from around the world, known as the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, for their congressional sponsors. They are notorious among economists and historians for limiting world commerce and making the Great Depression worse. Section 338 tariffs have never been used before. U.S. trade negotiators traditionally have favored another tool, Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, the provision Trump invoked for last month's forced labor tariffs. Section 338 authorizes the president to impose tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries that have discriminated against U.S. businesses. Unlike Section 301 sanctions, no investigation is required, nor is there any limit on how long the tariffs can stay in place. In announcing the Section 338 tariffs, Trump claimed that Canada discriminates against American exports of autos, alcohol, and cheese. Trump is angry because Canada and China were the only countries that punched back with retaliatory tariffs of their own when he slapped levies on their products last year. If a country retaliates against us, we're obviously not going to tolerate that, U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer told reporters Friday at the Iowa State Fair. We'll take action. My sense is that the Canadians, they want to have a more conciliatory approach, but we'll see. The U.S. is renegotiating a North American trade pact, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, that Trump strong-armed American neighbors into accepting in his first term. The threat of Section 338 tariffs give the United States leverage to seek fresh concessions from Ottawa. From Carney's perspective, you need USMCA to be renegotiated, said Christopher Gunderman, fellow in the economics program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You can't renegotiate it with a massive trade war going on. But Canada's public furor against Trump policies may limit Carney's ability to cut a deal. Canada could retaliate again if the new 50% tariffs take effect, potentially aggravating a trade fight. Canada's government cannot look like it's simply caving to the Trump administration's demands, said Daniel Belland, a political science professor at McGill University in Montreal. Making further concessions without getting something meaningful in exchange would probably lead to a strong backlash. The risk is for the Carney government to make Canada look weak, and therefore even more vulnerable to future trade and geopolitical bullying on the part of the Trump administration. Dominic LeBlanc, Canada's Minister for U.S. Trade, met with Greer on Monday. He was tight-lipped afterward. The work is continuing, he said. We continue to do our job. We're going to talk about something extremely aggravating now, and it is, as you would suspect, the Strait of Hormuz. This is an article from Fortune magazine, dated August 18th by Jordan Bloom. The title of the article is "The Global Freedom of the Seas is Dying in the Strait of Hormuz, and Everyone Everywhere Will Pay the Tolls." Concerns are growing that the de facto tolling of the Strait of Hormuz could trigger a domino effect for key shipping bottlenecks worldwide, creating more global inflation and effectively killing key components of international maritime law. As Iran insists on some form of fee structure for traversing the now infamous strait, and the U.S. increasingly seems unable to prevent it, the rising expectation is that other nations may insist on new fees elsewhere, such as Asia's Strait of Malacca, Europe's and Africa's Strait of Gibraltar, as well as key waterways impacted by Russia's war in Ukraine. I think that the freedom of the seas is dead, said Michelle Bruhard, head of policy and geopolitical risk for the Kepler Energy Intelligence firm. The way that we've known maritime security is moving into a new era, and the rules are still getting rewritten, Bruhard told Fortune. It's going to look different than what we've seen before. It's going to be expensive. It's going to be inflationary. And it's also going to create a lot of benefits for people who start onshoring industrialization. The so-called freedom of the seas is the century-old recognition that maritime transit and commerce should be free and open to all. The absolute freedom of navigation was insisted in Woodrow Wilson's famed 14-point statement of peace to end World War I. That legality is carried today through the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas. In that vein, the post-World War II order is burning to the ground, Bruhard said. The trend was already in the works with President Trump's return to office, and the so-called Donroe Doctrine, emphasizing regionalism and control over the Western Hemisphere. It's just accelerating now with the Iran war, she said. Shipping companies, insurance firms, and more would certainly oppose tolling structures. They're already threatening to cancel coverage on vehicles that pay tolls or involuntary fees, but that doesn't mean that they can prevent them, she said. Iran is demanding a 5 or 7% service fee per barrel of oil that would generate close to $20 billion annually, and that's not even counting fees on other cargoes, such as natural gas, petrochemicals, helium, fertilizer, and container cargoes. While analysts are skeptical that such high charges would come to fruition, many see a fee system of some kind as inevitable. And Bruhard believes it's increasingly an inevitability that more fees will be charged for cargoes to move through other straits as other nations seek to capitalize, such as Malaysia and Indonesia, in the Strait of Malacca and Morocco with the Strait of Gibraltar. Once Iran said they were going to charge a fee, if they charge a toll, then everyone is going to charge a toll, Bruhard said. This is one of the last known natural resources that someone can make money off of. Imagine you're Malaysia, you're a relatively poor country. Now, all of a sudden, you can charge a toll. You're going to be a relatively rich country. Morocco could become a richer country, she said. It's an entirely new commoditized asset that did not exist before. There is an ongoing debate in energy and geopolitical circles as to whether some kind of fee structure, even a so-called voluntary one, is an inescapability or a leveraging tactic to win Iran the economic freedoms from sanctions that it desires. Bob McNally, former White House energy advisor under George W. Bush and founder of the Rapidan Energy Group, believes Iran would likely settle for tiny voluntary service fees, similar to what already exists at the Strait of Malacca. We look at the whole question of Hormuz tolls as mainly an Iranian bargaining chip that they're willing and able to give up for big sanctions relief and other things, McNally said. We just don't think heavy-handed Iranian tolls are going to be the future. That could be wrong, though. Another argument is that Iran's oil-producing neighbors, the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC, may opt for regular payments to Iran instead of a per-vessel fee system to keep Hormuz open, said Gregory Brew, senior analyst for Iran and energy with the Eurasia Group. My expectation has been that money will be delivered to the Iranians in some way, shape, or form, Bruce said. It will likely come from the GCC states, and it will likely come in the form of voluntary fees that are meant to cover the costs of managing the strait. And that is very different than the minuscule voluntary fees in Malacca, he said. I think the Malacca comparison will be made to frame the agreement in Hormuz as legal and acceptable, Brew added. The difference will come in the quantity of funds delivered. The Iranians won't accept a nominal minor amount. They'll want something more substantial, and the GCC will likely have to deliver them what they want. Indonesia and Malaysia already have publicly flirted with tolling the Strait of Malacca this year, but have also insisted they'll avoid doing so for now. Even though it would have violated the freedom of navigation, Bruhart said there's an argument that the U.S. should have worked with Turkey and others to make Russia pay tolls through the Bosporus Strait as punishment for invading Ukraine, instead of capping the prices of Russia's oil and gas sales. Making Russia's oil the most expensive in the world would have punished Russia more than making its oil the cheapest and benefiting the oil buyers, especially China, she said. In such a way, Bruhard said, there's an argument that the freedom of the seas is no longer ideal for the modern world. Freedom of the seas makes sense in a world where everybody's friends with each other. But in a world like now, where there are a lot of hostilities, and you have the rising power of China, maybe freedom of navigation does not make sense, Bruhard said. As such, this would hasten onshoring and the building up of domestic supply chains, but it would also prove inflationary for essentially everything. In the case of oil, though, tolls charged on cheaper oil on open straits would prove less costly than the oil spikes of today, she said. And worldwide tolls would also apply to container ships, essentially all exported goods, and not just oil and gas tankers. Everything that we've seen that has been inflationary has been on commodity prices, Bruhart said. In the world of tolls on straits, you're going to have higher prices on the transit of container goods. And 90% of global trade happens on the water. It's not just commodities, it's everything. All global trade is happening on the water. Here's a question for all of you. Do you remember the days when companies were operated as a big family? If you do, you have a good memory. Here's an article from Fortune magazine by Preston Ford, dated August 17th. Reed Hastings says he learned why companies aren't families after laying off one-third of Netflix. You would never lay off two of your kids. Long before becoming a Hollywood mainstay with a market cap of over $315 billion, Netflix was struggling to stay afloat. After the dot-com bust, the then DVD rental company was forced to make its first major round of layoffs in 2001, cutting roughly one-third of its workforce. For Netflix co-founder Reed Hastings, the experience drove home a lesson about how to think about a company. It may be a tight-knit team, but it isn't a family. People respect great teams, and they respect families and how we operate, Hastings recently told Semaphore. But if you describe yourself as a family at a company, you better not do a layoff. You would never lay off two of your kids, right? Then people can get very cynical if you say it's a family but don't operate that way. Netflix soon found a path forward, capitalizing on the rise of DVD players, pivoting to a subscription-based DVD delivery service, and going public in 2002. But Hastings argued that getting too close makes employees feel protected, even when their performance falls short. We realized, wow, maybe we should do a one-third layoff every year, the 65-year-old said. And of course, that's impractical. But we said, how about if we keep the bar high and we really think about us as a championship sports team rather than a family? Hastings, who has an estimated net worth of $4.4 billion, served as Netflix's CEO from 1999 to 2023. He then became chairman, but stepped down earlier this year. Like most major companies, Netflix has endured rounds of layoffs through its history. But Hastings said the goal hasn't been simply to cut costs or reduce headcount. It's about making sure the company has the right roster to compete and making changes when it doesn't. If you say it's like a championship sports team, and we've got all these competitors, and we want to win the championship, then people understand why coaches make changes throughout the year to try and do their guess of the best way to win the championship. Today, Netflix defines success by performance, not seniority, tenure, or loyalty. Managers are also expected to regularly apply what Netflix calls its keeper test for their employees. We expect leaders to be strong developers of talent, it says on the Netflix website, and to ensure they have the right players at every position. We ask them to apply what we call the keeper test, asking, if X wanted to leave, would I fight to keep them? Or, knowing everything I know today, would I hire X again? If the answer is no, we believe it's fairer to everyone to part ways quickly. Netflix pairs high expectations with flexibility. Salaried employees aren't bound to traditional 9-to-5 work schedules or even a prescribed vacation calendar. Netflix also offers unlimited paid time off and parental leave. While time away may be observed differently depending on your location and role, we believe in taking the time you need so you're bringing your best to work, Netflix's website says. Hastings is hardly alone in concluding that the family business metaphor can create problems, particularly when companies have to make difficult decisions about their workforce. Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky has admitted that he learned that lesson during the pandemic. As he laid off roughly 25% of his workforce, he told employees he had a deep feeling of love for all of you. Looking back, he said he realized the language blurred an important distinction. I wrote that letter fairly quickly, Chesky said on Rethinking Podcast in 2024. I didn't have a lot of time, and so I wrote what I felt, and that's what I felt. And I was pretty emotional when I was writing it, and it is true that a company's not a family. In fact, we had to make that pivot. He added, we used to refer to ourselves as a family, and then we did have to fire people, or they'd have to leave the company, and you don't fire members of your family. Shopify CEO Toby Lotke reached a similar conclusion. In 2021, he warned managers against describing the e-commerce company as a family, arguing that doing so could make it harder to hold employees accountable. The idea is preposterous. You are born into a family. You never choose it, and they can't unfamily you, he said in a letter published by Business Insider. Lotke specifically pushed back against employees using the term Shopafam, especially among younger employees. The dangers of family thinking are that it becomes incredibly hard to let poor performers go, he added. Shopify is a team, not a family. We're going to do another article on tariffs now, this one concerning who is getting the money back and who is not. This is by Mia Osman-Bekoff from Fortune magazine, dated August 19th. Fortune 500 companies got billions in tariff refunds. Here's who's giving the customers a cut and who isn't. Some of America's biggest companies are receiving hundreds of millions of dollars in tariff refunds or booking even larger financial benefits. However, many consumers are wondering if those refunds will find their way back into their wallets. After the Supreme Court ruled that the International Emergency Economic Powers Act did not give the president authority to impose tariffs, major Fortune 500 companies, including Amazon and Target, have received hundreds of millions of dollars in tariff refunds. Some have pledged to issue refunds to consumers who bore increased costs thanks to the tariffs, while others have stayed mum on the subject. The Trump administration said as of July 31st, it certified $100 billion in tariff refunds, including interest, out of the $166 billion it had collected. Amazon, ranking number one on the Fortune 500, stands out as one of the largest companies to have already collected refunds. The e-commerce giant said we received approximately $640 million of tariff refunds under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act during the second quarter of 2026, according to its SEC filing. The amount represented the significant majority of refunds it expects to receive. Amazon has said it may offer refunds to only a limited number of customers impacted by the tariffs. Target received almost $1 billion in refunds during the second quarter, it said on Wednesday. The department store received $994 million in tariff refunds, adding $752 million to net earnings, for a total of $1.88 billion and $1.65 to earnings per share. Target CFO Jim Lee confirmed the company will not issue refunds as a result of the company's IEEPA refunds, but will use the money toward bringing lower prices. We have, and we will continue to, invest in price to ensure our guests are getting tremendous value each and every time they visit us at Target, Lee told Modern Retail. Nike has also received most of what it was owed. The sportswear company said it expected to recover $986 million. According to its filing, Nike had received $302 million as of May 31st and recorded another $684 million as an outstanding IEEPA tariff receivable. Nike has remained quiet on whether consumers will see any refunds, even as consumers sue the company for not refunding tariff-related costs. FedEx is a different case. The company and its competitor, UPS, have begun returning refunds to consumers earlier this month. The delivery company said its reported cash balance included approximately $800 million in tariff refunds, but that money was being held for refunds to customers, according to its filing. FedEx previously sued the federal government, seeking a full refund of tariffs it had paid. The results are mixed for automakers. Ford reported a $1.3 billion one-time tariff benefit, reflecting tariffs it paid between March 2025 and February 2026. Similarly, General Motors recorded a $500 million favorable adjustment tied to previously charged tariffs, which GM said it believed were refundable in its filing. Neither disclosure, however, confirms that the full amount had already been received in cash. Stellantis, the maker of Jeep and Ram, received a tariff refund of £400 million, about $467 million. Other companies have reported large financial benefits without making clear how much has actually been received. Apple reported a boost from tariff refunds, disclosing that the refunds added approximately 2 percentage points to its fiscal third quarter gross margin and contributed 11 cents to diluted earnings per share. Apple said it will invest its tariff refund into domestic manufacturing. For other major companies, the tariff refund situation is unclear after they sued the Trump administration for refunds. Costco said it would issue tariff refunds to consumers after being hit with 4 class action lawsuits, alleging the company passed on tariff costs and raised prices. Kohl's, which paid about $190 million in tariffs, applied for roughly $140 million in refunds, but said its latest quarterly filing that it had not received any payments. Home Depot said in its May quarterly filing that it received an immaterial amount after the quarter ended, at its August 18th earnings release, said its guidance includes IEEPA tariff refunds, which are expected to partially offset unplanned fuel, energy, and other product input costs. Other companies that also sued the Trump administration include Revlon, J.Crew, and Bumblebee Foods. Walmart said in a May disclosure that its financial guidance did not assume any impact from tariff refunds, saying it won't offer refunds to consumers, but that it will put that money toward lowering prices. Tesla was similarly cautious in its latest quarterly filing, stating that it may be eligible for refunds of previously paid tariffs, but that the recoverability and timing remain uncertain. The company previously sued the Trump administration over its China tariffs in 2020. Next, we're going to do a few quick articles about some major topics in the business community. First, President Donald Trump said he was delaying his plan to impose 50% tariffs on a range of Canadian products after the two countries reached a last-minute agreement. ABC and parent company Disney sued the Trump administration and the FCC for allegedly waging a retaliatory campaign against the network after FCC head Brendan Carr threatened its broadcast license. As the latest deadline to reach a peace deal in the Iran conflict expired, Iran said the Strait of Hormuz will remain closed until the U.S. agrees to its demands, leading oil prices to rise on Tuesday being August 18th. Google plans to acquire a trove of data for training AI from the bankrupt Spirit Airlines, including nearly 100 million passenger names, as well as employee records, for $10 million. The move generated backlash from a major flight attendant union, with a bankruptcy judge set to decide whether to approve the sale on Wednesday, August 17th. Just as the economy is split by income, so too is the housing market, with wealthy buyers propping up demand for higher-end properties. Home prices overall were nearly flat month over month in July, as everyday buyers have been priced out of the market due to high mortgage rates. Americans are increasingly pessimistic about AI, a new Pew Research Center survey found. For the first time, a majority of young adults are more concerned about the technology than excited by it, the research shows. 55% is the share of adults under 30 who said they feel more concerned than excited, a sharp uptick from 39% just 2 years ago. 71% is the percentage of people who believe AI will lead to fewer job opportunities. 2021, excitement about AI has dropped among all age groups in the last 5 years, with the steepest drop among those under 30. And now a slightly longer article, this from Fortune magazine, dated August 18th. How London's Electrify rolls up YouTube channels, turning creators into cash cows. Co-CEO Ian Shepherd and Owen Marr think they've found the answer to the problem that's long kept institutional investors wary of acquiring brands in the $250 billion creator economy, turning volatile, personality-driven brands into sustainable media businesses. Their startup, London-based Electrify Video Partners, buys majority equity stakes in established independent YouTube channels, which it calls creator-founder knowledge brands. It then provides capital and operational support to scale them. The company has grown rapidly since its 2021 founding, adding at least 9 flagship YouTube channels to its portfolio. Its largest media property, Veritasium, whose channel posts science-oriented videos like how one company secretly poisoned the planet, boasts 21 million subscribers and over 4 billion views. According to PitchBook, the company has attracted roughly $185 million from private equity firms, including London's Capital D and New York City's Equitable Capital and MEP Capital, on the bet that these brands can have a life beyond their original creators. While advertisers keep flocking to influencers, Forbes' top 50 creators earned a collective $1 billion in 2026. Investors worry that these brands are too dependent on the personality in front of the camera. Mayer and Shepard think the solution lies in less flashy categories of channels and building well-staffed production and development teams. Electrify seeks out YouTube channels that are established leaders in a certain niche, be it coding, aviation, or Lego. They are particularly drawn to brands that produce videos that inform and inspire. In other words, mini-documentaries tailor-made for millennials and Generation Z who are curious but have short attention spans. Electrify's goals are high. Board chairman and former YouTube exec Timothy Shea sees the video channel roll up as the Condé Nast of the creator economy, where every brand in the portfolio is somebody's favorite. Institutional investors are starting to really quickly wake up to this, insists Shea. On an entirely different front, Scott Bessent, the Secretary of the Treasury, has started a buyback of longer-term maturities in the bond market to stabilize the yields. Here's a quick article on what the market thinks of that. It is from Fortune magazine, dated August 20th. Bessent's $4 billion bond buyback plan is like rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, given the U.S. national debt of $40 trillion, ING says. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent made a surprise intervention into the bond market yesterday, promising to at least double its buybacks of long-dated bonds, such as the 10, 20, and 30-year treasuries. The current maximum size of $2 billion per operation will be at least $4 billion per operation. The buying will start on September 9th. A total of up to $128 billion could be spent over the course of a year. The intent of the operation is to raise the price of the bonds and thus lower the interest yield on them. Long-dated bonds are used to set interest rates on a wide range of credit products, such as mortgages, car loans, and commercial loans. If rates fall, that credit could become cheaper to obtain. The intervention worked. The yield on the 30-year Treasury fell from 5.3% to 5.19% before ticking up a little to 5.218% this morning. That's a big single-day decline in bond land. And with that, folks, we're done. Thank you so much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is Business World, and I'm Steve Klein. See you next Monday at 11. Bye for now.